going to be on the debt structures. This is not only related to real estate, but of course we have a new real estate investment trust and infrastructure investment trust regime in India. So that's exciting and interesting to a lot of people. So we'll try and cover a bit of that. We have about 50 to 60 people who are joining us via the telephone. So the way I think we would like to do this is we have broken this up into two panels. The first panel will begin right now, and 45 minutes of panel discussion, which I will moderate. And then the panelists are in front of you. Their introductions and details are in the programs that you have, so I won't spend time on introducing each one of them. 15 minutes of Q&A. We'll probably try and do the Q&A first for those of you present here, and then follow that on with questions from those who have dialed in. After that, we have a panel on real estate investment trust, so that will be more REIT-focused, but it will also discuss some of the tax issues and other issues that most of you are always grappling with. And then we'll have a networking session outside in the foyer from 4 o'clock to 5 o'clock. So let me now begin this session by introducing the first panel, which is going to talk on evolving structures for investments and exits. Now you'll have to hear my voice once again. I've already given you a bit of an introduction of what's happening in India and how fast and frenetic things are. Clients are asking us questions on a daily basis as to what are the new structures available, what are the tax issues post-Vodafone and post-general anti-avoidance rules, how are things going to change. So I think keeping that perspective in mind, I'm going to start off the panel by asking a question to Rohan. Rohan is a partner with Xander Funds, and he is based in Singapore but has a lot of experience in investing in India across number of core and non-core real estate assets, retail assets. So Rohan is aptly placed to try and tell us. Rohan, what's your experience been as far as your investments in India are concerned, and do you see a change in LP interest in India, or how your perception of India is post the elections and the new government coming in?
That question is going to require a very long answer, but I'll try to be short. There are two parts to the question. One is, what has our experience been?
Yeah.
I think our experience has been strangely good. Versus a lot of feedback that I get from a lot of other investors. obviously, there are aspects of the business that we're exposed to, such as currency, et cetera, which is beyond our control. But that set aside, I think some of the investment theses that we set out with back in 2005, we're almost 10 years old in India, have played out pretty okay. Like in any real estate business anywhere in the world, there have been surprises. But all in all, I think a staggering evolution, I think, that has happened since 2005, where foreign real estate investment in India was practically unknown because of regulation. I don't know how much you guys know, but effectively, the regulation permitted investment in 2005, and I think everybody was finding their feet in terms of regulation, what was allowed, what was not allowed. There were gray, notifications on policy and investment in asset classes, strategies, et cetera. It was all very gray. And I think investors, counterparties in India, developers, the government themselves were all finding their feet on what's really the right, what's the meaning of this regulation and how it needs to interpret into investments into the country. So I think the first few years was really that, and I think it was probably even though there was a lot of tailwind in terms of capital flowing into India, in terms of a lot of interest in India because everybody felt that India was the next best thing, and that was rather unfortunate for India because it got a lot of capital, but didn't know how to deal with the capital in several instances. From a regulatory perspective, soft services, which is law firms and you know, I'm not making any point here, but law firms, accounting firms, investment managers, operators, etc. I mean, everybody was finding their feet. So there was a bit of a flux, and there was a lot of capital, which basically meant bad deals. However, I think since that phase, and if you look at today, what's encouraging is that regulation has tremendously evolved. There is more clarity. I can't say there's clarity to the extent that, you know, we would like, but maybe our expectations are too high. But there is substantial clarity on what you can do and what you can't do. And I think that line is very clear, even though people still flirt with the boundaries there. I think there's been a phase where it was the reverse, where, you know, regulation was favorable, market was favorable, but there was no capital, right? And I think that's what happened in the last, let's say, 3 or 4 years. And I think today, in the last 3 months, it's too soon for me to tell, frankly. I know there's a lot of optimism. I fear the optimism because I think, you know, expectations lead to disappointment if they are not fulfilled. So at least what I advise my friends, my, you know, my peers, my investors, developers, partners, everybody is that, you know, guys, take everything with a pinch of salt and let's see how this plays out, because we've got to make sure that we manage our expectations. And I don't think India is going to get too many chances, right? It's been bad for the last, you know, like I said, 36 months. People have lost a lot of money. And I don't think the economy can afford for that to happen, and for various reasons. So, you know, that's my long-winded answer.
I think that was a very interesting answer, because normally when you ask someone who invests in India, what's your experience been like, the first sentence of the response is always negative. But I think Rohan's answer was positive. And then, of course, one has to be realistic when you look at some of the challenges that I was mentioning obviously exist in India. So, Rohan, I take it that you're going to continue, obviously, investing in India, and you've had a good amount of experience. So you also know what the pitfalls are, and you're able to share that experience with all the stakeholders that you work with. I think one of the important aspects that everyone would want to know, and maybe, Nishchal, I can ask you this question, is how have investments into India been traditionally structured, and what changes are you seeing as of now, maybe post-Vodafone, post-general anti-avoidance rules, the whole Mauritius-Singapore debate that continues. So maybe your views on that.
Sure. So as Rohan mentioned, 2005 to 2008-09 was a period of blind investing, or what you call honeymoon period for some of the funds. Or the other way to also call it is, you know, it was a period of high tide. But what happened post that, because of the Lehman crunch and global recession, a lot of these funds lost their money. And that was the time when, you know, the tide went away and a lot of them realized that they were swimming naked. So what happened from 2006 to 2009, there were a number of equity deals which took place. There were a lot of exposure which the funds wanted to take on Indian assets and Indian promoters. But because a lot of them couldn't make money post-2009 because of the global recession, and India was also impacted a lot because of that, we started seeing a shift from equity deals to debt deals. The comfort which the LPs had with the debt deals was there was a regular flow of coupon which was coming from the portfolio company, as compared to equity deal where you invest in 2006-07 and till the end of life of the fund, till the time the exit happens, they're not seeing any dollar coming back. So we saw more and more fundraising happening on the debt side as compared to equity side post 2009-10. And that is where the structuring of the funds also changed a lot, because the exits were not happening, the returns which they were expected, which they were expecting was not coming. So what happened and what became critical was, how do you structure your investments into India? Because if there is a substantial tax hit on the IRR which the fund is making, then again it's going to be detrimental to the investors. So earlier, the equity structures were mostly routed through Mauritius, and Mauritius still remains one of the best jurisdictions to invest into India. But what happened was, because of the shift from equity to debt, which happened post 2009, some of the other jurisdictions started gaining importance, like Singapore and Netherlands. Cyprus was also one of the good jurisdictions which was used for making debt investments into India. But as we know, there were two things which happened with Cyprus. One was the banking crisis which Cyprus went through, because of which a lot of international investors became uncomfortable with Cyprus. And second was India declared Cyprus as a non-cooperative jurisdiction from a tax perspective, which means that any payouts to any Cyprus entity was subject to a high withholding tax of 30%. So the choices became limited post 2009 between Mauritius, Singapore, and Netherlands. And because there were a lot of funds which wanted to make debt investments into India, Mauritius, again, because it does not have a good treaty with India on the interest or the debt side, Singapore and Netherlands started gaining prominence. Between Singapore and Netherlands, again, Singapore has been favored a lot as compared to Netherlands, again, because of the fact that it's easy to set up your office, or, you know, if you want to establish presence or substance in Mauritius, in Singapore, it's easier as compared to having people based in Netherlands. So we have seen both type of structures, Singapore and Netherlands. We have also set up a couple of structures in Netherlands because the withholding tax on coupon in between India and Netherlands is only 10% as compared to 15% in Singapore. So debt was one of the reasons why Singapore and Netherlands were favored as compared to Singapore. One of the other reasons why Singapore gained prominence over Mauritius was on account of the general anti-avoidance rules, which were first proposed in 2010 by the government. It is scheduled to be effective from 1st April 2015. We don't know in what form the government is going to dilute the GAAR provisions, but at least for the time being, for the GPs who are able to have a setup in Singapore, they are preferring to set up the new funds in Singapore as compared to Mauritius. For the existing funds, which are already based out of Mauritius, one of the risks that they are facing is that if they now shift to Singapore, that itself could be considered as acknowledging the fact that there was no substance in Mauritius, and that's where the risk lies. So broadly, in nutshell, the flavor of the season is debt, and because it's debt, Singapore and Netherlands have been used a lot for making investments into India.
Thanks, Nishal. I think that's very interesting. So the flavor is debt, and for many of you, debt was always considered the last option any foreign investor considered when they were investing in India, because we had a number of regulations, and we continue to have regulations on what we call external commercial borrowings. So everything from who could lend, who could borrow, what were the interest rates, what were the end use of that money was controlled and continues to be controlled to a large extent. A number of sectors even today can't avail of an external commercial borrowing, lending from overseas or borrowing from overseas. But as Nishal mentioned, there were certain other avenues that could be structured, and you could get the debt aspect without, for example, coming under the purview of the external commercial borrowing guidelines, which, as I mentioned, were very restrictive. At the same time, you could get equity upside. So maybe, Ruchir, since you've been doing a lot of structures on the debt side, could you tell us what are some of the new and evolving structures that you've seen and that you've been advising your clients on the debt side?
Sure. I guess private equity was, in India, is not very old. Started from 2006, 2007, really in all asset classes. And in certain growth capital asset classes like tech, etc., equity still remains the flavor. But in certain asset classes like real estate, or especially those kind of asset classes where there's a constant need for cash upstreaming, debt is becoming very, very important these days. Because when you are upstreaming from an Indian company, there are major tax issues. When an Indian company has to upstream cash to its shareholders, let's say it's a real estate company, where it's self-liquidating, it's selling off the units, or it's commercial, where you keep getting lease rentals, or it is an infra project where you're getting rentals, toll bridges and things like that, when you want to upstream to your shareholders, which are offshore, the challenge that comes is that at first, the Indian company would have to book corporate taxes, you know, would have to book income and pay corporate tax at the rate of about 30% plus surcharge and cess. That's 30%. Then when you distribute, if by way of dividends, then you pay a 17% tax or a 15% base rate plus surcharge. So effectively talking about a 45% kind of a tax. Earlier you used to do it by way of, you know, upstreaming was structured by way of buybacks, where the Indian company could buy back the shares of the foreign shareholder, and we would structure that as a form of capital gains. But today, buybacks are also subject to an additional 20% tax. Now, interesting part is both buybacks and dividend are actually a form of additional tax which the Indian company pays on the distributions. It is not a tax which is paid on behalf of the non-resident. It's not a withholding tax. Because it's not a withholding tax, the recipient who is receiving the dividends or the buyback proceeds does not get the credit for the tax paid in India, right? So it becomes completely tax inoptimized. One of the reasons why this product, you know, why debt becomes important is because when you push in debt into the Indian company, whatever the Indian company pays out on top of that debt, you know, on top of the debentures, let's say, will be a form of a deductible for the Indian company. So not only do you save on your entire 45% taxes of the, you know, corporate taxes plus distribution, you also actually claim a reduction at the Indian company level. Then one on the coupon, etc., that you pay out on that debt, there is a withholding tax in India, in case of Singapore, 15%, in case of Netherlands, 10%. And you would typically get a deduction in Singapore. So, for instance, you're not tax exempt in Singapore. You would be 17% taxed in Singapore. 15% would be the credit for the tax you paid in India. So effectively, your tax liability is only 2% in Singapore. Now, what form of debt should this be, right? Because, as Vivek said, debt was earlier perceived only to be external commercial borrowings, which was very restrictive. And, you know, India as an economy does not like foreign debt. So we pioneered this instrument, listed non-convertible debentures in 2008. That was a time when the government realized that just like we are having buoyant capital markets in terms of equity, we need to have buoyant debt markets as well, right? And we simplified and substantially simplified our debt listing regime in such a manner that today, listing of these debentures, what we call a listed non-convertible debentures, and these are issued on private placement basis, right? They're not issued to the public, they're issued to a select number of people. That kind of listing is just a couple of pages of disclosures and a couple of days for the entire listing process. It is extremely simplified, right? Now, who can subscribe to these debentures? Today, earlier there were restrictions that only a foreign institutional investor or certain SEBI registered or regulated bodies could only subscribe. Today, any person can register as what we call as a foreign portfolio investor. Even a foreign individual or a foreign company which is not regulated anywhere can also register as a foreign portfolio investor under the Category 3 FPI norms and subscribe to these kind of bonds. So it's become very, very easy for everyone to subscribe, right? Now, another benefit of these kind of bonds is that, you know, there are restrictions in terms of sectors. Like if you invest in real estate, there's a lock-in requirement, there is a 50,000 square meters, which is now toned down 20,000, etc. If you invest through these bonds, there are no such sectoral restrictions. So for instance, you want to come into, let us say, an insurance company or a multi-brand retail company, you are free to do that. You can invest through these kind of bonds into that insurance company or wherever, and it's perfectly legit. So while you may not be able to get that, get in pure play equity interest, yet you would be able to have the economic structured in such a way that you are able to get whatever economic interest, 75-80%, whatever economics you need. These bonds have largely been structured in recent times as forms of structured equity. While the instrument may really be a bond, the returns on it and everything else is a form of structured equity. You can peg your returns to the price of the underlying equity share. You could peg it to the EBITDA. You could peg it to cash flows. You can also structure these bonds as payable when able kind of mechanisms, wherein your coupon or your yield goes up when the company makes more money. It goes down when there is no money, right? At the same time, what it gives maximum comfort and why has these been very particularly interesting for real estate has been that it gives you security interest. You can create a secure, which you could never do under earlier, you know, under foreign investment regimes. You can create security interest by way of mortgage, pledge, guarantees, hypothecation of receivables. All kind of security interest what you need can be created in favor of the foreign debenture holder through an onshore security trustee which really acts, you know, for your favor. So that structured, you know, the form of security interest has really been really attractive for many of these players who sometimes found, you know, Indian developer communities any which was a little tricky community, right? So, you know, there have been a little, you know, bit of arm twisting, etc. And when you have these kind of security mechanisms, you know, it becomes very, very simple. In the we've done about 1,500 of these till now. And in the times, we have hardly seen any disputes. There was just one of the disputes that came to light and they got settled. Now, when do you settle? You settle typically when, you know, you see teeth, right? And another thing which you need to keep, you know, Indian real estate marketers, you know, some of these evolving asset-heavy asset classes market have evolved from structures of pure equity to preferred equity to debt. And ultimately, I think what Ray and Rohan can comment on that, I think what people really realized in real estate and some of these markets was that you do not make 50, 80% or 100% kind of returns like sometimes you make in tech, right? Your returns are any which ways optimized around 20, 25 or 28%. So if you are really making those kind of returns, if you're making debt-like returns, then your instrument rather be debt. Then you make rather pure play debt returns where you're able to get tax-optimized, you know, returns. And again, sorry, just one more thing. Most of the exits in reality have been, you know, secondaries have been fewer. Put options on the promoters have been, have formed a larger number, right? And the problem is that if you do a put option on the promoters or an Indian resident, they know the Indian government does not like it. You know, there are restrictions. Even today, you can do a put only on fair market value, and when the company is not doing well, you don't know what the fair market value is. But when you're doing these kind of instruments, what you're doing is really debt. So there is no regulatory concerns in as much as saying that there's a put option and all that. All those restrictions don't lie. And that is why you would see a large amount of investments in real estate and other asset-heavy asset classes being structured in the form of structured debt.
Thanks, Ruchir. I think in the bags that you have, there's also a book that we have written on, which will give you more detail on this non-convertible debenture, as it's popularly called in India, NCD structure.
So it's page 20.
Page 20.
If you want to look at it, all about listed non-convertible. The book is called Private Equity and Private Debt in Real Estate. It's in the bags.
Just to add to what Ruchir said, while this is used primarily in, we've seen this being used primarily in real estate and certain asset-heavy classes, we've also seen this being used in other situations. Situations, for example, where there are restrictions, for example, on sectoral caps in certain sectors. Situations where it's an internal financing structure between group companies, where for some reason equity is not working. And debt is preferred. But as I mentioned, the ECB guidelines are very stringent. So a listed bond is the structure that is really the flavor of the day today in India. And for all of those of you who are doing business in India, you should consider this instrument for either yourselves or your clients. But I think, Ruchir, you mentioned that this is becoming very interesting. And you also mentioned that you can create a security. We all know in India that the enforcement mechanism, you have the NCD, you've created a security over an asset, let's say it's land in the case of real estate, or let's say you've got any other form of security over movable property, for example. The question is, how good is that security? Are you able to practically enforce it? The borrower has defaulted, you are a lender who holds the bond, and now you go to India and say, I'm going to enforce it, the borrower puts his hands up and says, you know, all the best. So I think practical issues with respect to enforcement of security is of importance. And Deepak, maybe you could give us some insight from the documentation that you've been drafting for clients and discussions that we've been having. How does the enforcement mechanism work? How easy is it or how complicated is it?
Sure. So I think, like Ruchir mentioned, one of the major advantages of the listed NCD route is that you can create security. And now this gives comfort because, now not Zander, but yeah, there are a lot of funds who have burned their fingers. Now having security gives some comfort to the investors. Now, but there has always been an apprehension as to, you know, now there is security. Security could be 1.5x, 2x, 2.5x. But how good is that security? Now can I enforce it on a timely basis? that has always been a concern, you know. So a couple of years back, if you went for enforcement of security, it could take many, many years. It could sometimes take even decade to enforce the security. But now, with the approach of the court, this process of enforcement of security has been substantially reduced. It can come down to even 1.5 to 2 years, within which you can actually enforce the security. So before we move into how this process can be shortened, briefly as to what are the forms of security which are typically created to secure a debt or a listed non-convertible debenture. So first is the mortgage. Mortgage can be, again, of different kinds. It can be English mortgage, simple mortgage. And this is, again, on the immovable property, which is in India. Second is the pledge. Pledge can be of the shares of the company in which you have invested. It can be promoter who is pledging his own shares. Or it could also be pledge of shares of listed companies, which the promoter owns. Then third is the escrow mechanism. Though it is not a typically a security, but yeah, escrow mechanism really helps because, for instance, like in a asset-heavy class where there is a regular upstreaming of cash, so all the cash which the company makes or the developer or any other infra project makes, that can be deposited in an escrow. So from the escrow, the money can be distributed in the way the investor wants it. So the document can be structured wherein we can say that, you know, first, whatever, until 100x, 1x, 2x, the money goes to the investor, then the money goes to the promoter, or it can be until I receive, let's say, 20% IRR, the distribution could be 70-30 ratio. Once I've hit the 20% IRR, the distribution could be in 50-50 ratio. So everything can be structured using the escrow mechanism. Now, escrow typically is controlled by both the investor and the promoter. And in case of default, we could also build in a provision saying that once the default happens, the investor could give an instruction to the escrow agent, and from then henceforth, the escrow will be solely be controlled by the investor. So then the developer or then the company or the promoter has absolutely no role to play in the escrow. So all the cash can be controlled by the investor. And then we have the guarantees. Guarantee is also a very useful mechanism to enforce or to rather to get the promoters or to get the company on table. It can be guarantee, can be either a corporate guarantee of the holding company, or it could also be individual guarantee of the promoters. So these are the kind of securities. Now, earlier, why it used to take a lot of time? Because whenever you do go for enforcement of security, there are two steps. One is the liability crystallization process, and second is the actual enforcement. Now, during this liability crystallization process itself, the company or the, you know, the other side, they will claim a lot of frivolous cases, a lot of frivolous defenses they will bring up, which delays the entire enforcement mechanism process. So just to even prove that the company or the promoter owes you money could take many, many years. Now, this liability crystallization process can be shortened using the arbitration mechanism. Now, so arbitration can again, because now we have all these institutional arbitrations and we have LCI, SEAC, which have set up their offices in India, these arbitrations can be time-bound. So in the document itself, you can provide that the arbitration has to be consummated within, let's say, 90 day or 120 day. So the arbitrator then has to give their the award within that time-bound period. Now, this, what it does is, this arbitration, it crystallizes the liability. And now once this arbitration gives this award is, you can go to the court and it becomes enforceable as a decree of the court. So it has that power. So the entire process of liability crystallization now gets reduced to a few months. And courts also earlier, they used to interfere a lot in the arbitration process. But yeah, but these days now, in the past 1 to 2 years, there has been a spate of judgments where the courts have clearly given, they have taken a hands-off approach that once the parties have decided and the document is very clear that the dispute has to be settled through arbitration, they take a hands-off approach and they let the parties decide and they do not interfere in the arbitration process. So this liability crystallization, once it is done, the actual enforcement, whether it be pledge, mortgage, guarantee, or escrow, that can happen within a period of 1 to 2 years. So that way, the entire period has been shortened down. Now, before just one more thing. The like Richard mentioned, the security, it is not created in favor of the non-resident. So under Indian Exchange Control Regulation, security cannot be created in favor of non-residents, except in one or two cases. So what happens is the security is created in favor of a debenture trustee or a security trustee in India who acts for the benefit of all the bondholders. Now, these debenture trustees, they are regulated by SEBI, which is the exchange securities regulator in India. So they have their stringent norms they have to follow. and they, and also not only the securities market regulations, but they are also governed by the trust laws. So they have to act in the interest of the bondholders, and in case of any default, once the bondholders instruct the debenture trustee or the security trustee to enforce, they typically have to follow the process. So, and also, I think Vivek has been here in Singapore for past 8 years, so I think he has also seen a couple of arbitrations. So I think, Vivek, you might also just want to share the arbitration experience Singapore.
Thanks, Deepak. I think the bottom line is hybrid instrument, NCD, debt and equity, and hybrid enforcement mechanism, arbitration, and in the case of property, you have to go to court. So what this basically means is ensure that your documents, which are the debenture subscription agreement, for example, has an arbitration provision in it. Obviously, you need to see if there are Indian parties in its arbitration in India, because two Indian parties can't, it's not a decided situation yet, but can't really have an arbitration outside. And if they do it outside, like in Singapore, there could be other complications that could arise. So you could have SIAC rules, for example, that could be used to govern the arbitration between the debenture trustee, the bondholders, or anyone else in India. And once that award is passed, which before people went for arbitration used to go to court for the same relief, that's what used to take a long time. So make sure that you have an arbitration provision. At least you save that 5 to 10 years that you would typically spend in a court trying to crystallize your claim. And so that's a lot of time to spend. And once you have that, you go to court and you file an enforcement action in the case of property, or if it's not property, then you can file it for any other security that you've created. So overall, if all things go well, you can actually get your security enforced within a period of maybe 2 to 3 years, which many people would not believe if you spoke about the pace of decision-making of Indian courts. But this hybrid structure works. And we've seen that used quite well. Most of the agreements now have an arbitration provision. You have a time-bound arbitration, so you put a specific period down that the arbitrator has to decide within 90 days or within 120 days or whatever the parties have agreed at the time of drafting. So don't keep this as a midnight clause in the agreement. It's no longer a midnight clause. It's probably the first clause, because at the time you're entering into and the money is coming in, everything is great. But when things go wrong, then you relook at that arbitration clause or the dispute resolution clause in your contract, and you wonder what you were thinking when you were drafting it. One of the things that we do is that every investment document, whether it's a NCD document or it's equity or anything else, investment document, we give it to our litigation team in our firm before it is signed. Because as the panelists have mentioned, a lot of private equity and a lot of other investors have burned their hands in India in litigation over their investments. And it's only at that point of time do you realize that there are so many inadequacies in that dispute resolution provision that you spend about 3-4 years just fighting over that provision in a court before you even come to the merit of the case. So we give these documents to our litigation team, and we tell them to go through all the rights that each of the parties have and to tell us, has there been any recent judicial development, both in arbitration as well as from the courts, that would impact our client if things went wrong, if it was an enforcement of a put option, for example, and therefore, would they suggest that we change the language of the clause? Now, many of us work in are used to working in our silos. Corporate lawyers are corporate lawyers. They'll draft the document, and then when the litigation happens, it'll go to the litigation team. We've tried to get them involved from day one. So I think just wrapping up on Deepak's point, the hybrid form of enforcement also works. And maybe, Ruchir, I can quickly come to you. We have about 5 minutes left. Apart from NCD, are there any other structures that one should know about that are new and developing?
I guess there are two or three innovative things that you can probably structure. One is for those of you who have what we call as a foreign venture capital investor registration, you can actually achieve liquidation preference, because many times in documents you believe that rights like liquidation preference, etc., are just paper rights. That's because you do not believe because sometimes, you know, in India you cannot subscribe to redeemable instruments. You can only subscribe to equity and instruments convertible into equity. But with FVCI investments, or foreign venture capital investors can subscribe to redeemable instruments, redeemable preference shares, which can be structured in such a manner that whenever there's a liquidity event and the money has to be given out, the instruments get redeemed and the cash can be paid out, right? So one point when you're structuring, think about foreign venture capital investor registrations and think about liquidation preference and redeemable instruments. I guess the another interesting thing which has come up recently is Indian companies being allowed to list offshore. Earlier, there was a requirement that any Indian company could list offshore only if it was listed in India or simultaneously gets listed in India. Now, up to 51% of the capital of the Indian company can be diluted in favor of non-residents through what we call as a deposit receipt mechanism. So any Indian company, infrastructure company, real estate company, or any other company can list itself on Singapore or wherever. And I think this has become very important because I think the government realized that where we need to list is a matter of commercial discretion. And just by forcing people to list in India, it is not going to improve India's capital markets, right? So if you want infra, you go to Singapore, you need tech, you go to US or metals, minerals, go to London or wherever. So I think that is very important. Where we are using, where this is becoming more and more important is for foreign investors to in turn invest into the Indian company by way of DR mechanisms. So the foreign investor would actually subscribe to the debenture, would subscribe to the depository receipts of the Indian company, which are listed on Singapore or wherever, and through the depository, structure the same rights that he would have if he would have directly invested, right? And that is very much possible. That money can in turn now be used through a couple of structures to retire the existing private equity or debt in the Indian company, right? And why this works best for you is that this is entirely what we call as GAR sanitized. There is no issue, there's no question then that do you have substance in Singapore, do you have substance there or not, because the when you sell the deposit receipts on the floor, the Indian domestic tax law itself gives you an exemption that when you sell deposit receipts, there's no tax, right? So you get your rights, and when you're selling, the Indian, the you know, the buyer would not come and say that, look, I'm going to withhold taxes because you don't have adequate substance, because we'll say that Indian domestic tax law itself exempts, fully exempts, transfers of DRs on the floor of the exchange. So that is one innovative structure. The other, and I think that's going to pick up very soon, the third innovative structure is externalization. You know, Indian companies, the shareholding of the Indian companies being flipped offshore. And there are many such examples. So you would have an offshore company which would be in turn holding the Indian company. And I think that flips become, those flips become very important. I think most of the Chinese companies follow these structures because their holding companies typically offshore. It is easy from a regulatory perspective. It is easy from a management perspective, foreign investments, and it insulates you from foreign exchange exposure risk. You come in at dollar value, you exit at dollar value, but your entire income is still, income stream is still in India, and you're able to benefit, so you can also actually use your offshore holding company as the order booking center, right? So you book your orders there, service it in India, and you make that little, and you're also insulated from claims of Indian tax authorities, et cetera, because you're offshore. So I think both these structures, offshore listing is on page 75 of the same book, which sets out the benefits of why you should do it, how it is to be done, and page 80 is on externalization, how you're flipping the Indian companies offshore, you know, and how they're going public onto different markets.
Thanks, Richard. We are... We have about 5 more minutes. You heard, I think, enough from all the lawyers, and I think it's time to get someone who actually does the deals back on the job. So, Rohan, what would be, I mean, I know I'm going to ask you a very general question, but having heard all of this and coupled with your experience, few do and don'ts for investors. What are the three or four things that you think are the most important things to know if you're a foreign investor investing in India?
By the way, I have a question for you, gentlemen. After I answer this question,
right? So we'll start clocking our time.
Okay. do's and don'ts. I think the biggest lesson that at least we've kind of taught ourselves rather than learned is that, you know, India is not an easy market. I think we all know that, and it's not a market which you can invest in from, you know, remotely, you know, own paper securities. and hope for counterparties to perform, you know, by the book. So I think control is a very, very important aspect of our investing style. I think it's pretty much mandatory for us to take control positions. And when I say control, we don't need to own the business. We own a lot of businesses 100%, but it's not that we need to own, you know, 50, 60, 70%. It's nothing to do with ownership. It's got to do with control, operational control, bank account control, right? Not sitting on a board and attending a quarterly board meeting and passing a business plan, right? At least, you know, so I think it's being more hands-on. That's what we've learned. We have a large advisory team in India. I think we have about 80 people on the ground there for a particular strategy. We have another 40 people for another strategy, and 15 people for another strategy. So we have several strategies in India. And I think we benefit from directly operating assets ourselves, benefit from taking control positions in our partnerships. And we've clearly seen the benefits. It's a lot of work, frankly. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of pain. Sometimes I wonder if we're still in the investment management business. But I think to navigate through some of the challenges that are there in a country, where I think there's opportunity for sure. Otherwise, we wouldn't do it. You know, I think the effort needs to be put in. So it's not a market that you can kind of go in half measure. So any of you guys who are thinking of investing, go the whole hog, right? Don't have a one-member liaison office, you know, structure in India or advisor or whatever it is. I don't think that works. And if any of you are able to figure out how that works, please tell me, because I'd be happy to learn. So that was my answer to you. But I have a question for you on the NCDs. So I actually, frankly, and this is probably counterproductive for me to say, but I think it's counterintuitive, right? So on one hand, we say that in 2008, the government offered this structure to facilitate a vibrant debt market. But what's ending up happening is that there's no debt. These are equity deals, right? I mean, they don't even look and feel like debt. You just said that the coupon on the NCD is dependent on EBITDA, sales price, achievement, performance, etc. I don't understand how that debt is. It can be called whatever. The nomenclature to me is irrelevant. I think the underlying economics and the underlying security and the underlying instrument is really what tells you what flavor the instrument is. So my question, and you guys meet with regulators, government, etc. How long is this party going to last? Because I think it started as something and it's become something else.
So let me answer that very quickly in 5 minutes. Right. When we did the first deal, 2008, right,
is it a valid question?
It's a valid question.
I don't even know if it's valid.
It's a valid question, and that's a question which many people have today, right?
Okay.
Economic Times ran a front-page story saying foreign debt or structured debt entering into India, you know, and all the bad kind of words around it. It took a while for us to discuss with each of the regulators that there's nothing wrong in that, right? And because from a Reserve Bank of India perspective, they said, we've amended our schedule to say that you can do, and we have not posed restrictions on what kind of coupon limit, because coupon can be structured. Today, any lender can lend, and the coupon can be structured in whatever way you want, right? So RBI doesn't have a problem. SEBI said, this is from a private placement perspective, so I don't have a problem, right? And stock exchanges, well, we, you know, they said that we are only service providers, so we are not concerned. Whatever you want to list, we'll be happy to list. Since then, these deals kind of became very, very popular. But I think the perception that people had in mind, or the apprehension still remained, that is this legit, or are we doing something very cute, you know, structuring redemption premiums of the bond as a measure of cash flows and all of that. I think if you see today also, the maximum amount of deals which are happening are not really real estate. They're really into the financial services sector, where the redemption premium and the coupon is actually even being pegged to the cash flows. And where we draw comfort from, so what if this is on private placement basis? I think at some stage, the more the market grows, even today, out of the $51 billion limit that we have totally allocated, not even 50% has been used. So there is a constant encouragement by the government to use it. What can be a better form of encouragement from the Ministry of Finance than to slash the rates on debentures, on these kind, specifically these kind of debentures, listed non-convertible debentures subscribed by our foreign portfolio investors from 40% to 5%. Tax is probably the only determinant which shows where the government is heading. And it is not this, that the government does not know how these bonds are being structured, because these are all in public domain. There is a data which gets circulated, SEBI reports everything. Everything is on, you know, everything is listed. Sure. I think that perception that is something legit happening or not, or how long will the party last, is, I think, a valid question. But the way I look at it is that,
yeah,
I think if we have to have dominant markets, I think it is really commercial between the parties to discuss what form of coupon or how will the coupon be structured.
No, I get that. I mean, you know, and firstly, I'm a big fan of the NCD. That's all we've done in the last, you know, 36 months, I think, apart from other stuff. And to me, these are equity deals. I mean, they're not debt deals. They're equity deals. It's just a structure that helps you address time issues, preference issues, et cetera, in a clean manner. And there's as you rightly said, the counterparty obviously gets benefit of tax shields, et cetera. So I think it's overall value accretive. It's heartening to know that the regulators, SEBI, the central bank, and I'm sure DIPP and FIPB, which is the Foreign Investment Promotion Boards in India, are aware of what's happening, which is good, because, you know, the last thing you want is them showing up one day and saying, you know, what have all you guys been doing, right? And I think, you know, everybody has seen that happen in different countries. And I don't think we should single out India here, firstly, right? This stuff happens everywhere, right? Regulators show up on one fine day and say, what are you guys up to, right? I don't think that's an India thing, but regulators have been known to do that from time to time across geographies. So it's good to know that they know what's happening, and I guess what they're doing effectively is that if they want foreign investment, then it needs to effectively flow through a structure where the investor needs to see value.
I think so, debt, and if you see, you know, and there may be many debt players over here, I think in times to come, you would probably also see, just today we only look at foreign equity inflows. I think foreign debt inflows also need to be maximized, and that will also form a substantial portion of what we call as our, you know, foreign investment inflows. And I think that is also what, you know, the finance minister has been focusing on.
Sure. Just to add one more point, Rohan made a very valid point. So also on this point, SEBI has also recognized the fact that there are market-linked debentures which are being issued. So, you know, promoters of listed companies, they have taken raised money by way of debt and infused or bought the shares of listed companies, their own companies, and the returns to the investors are linked to the price of the underlying shares. So SEBI has acknowledged that these are being issued, and they have just provided guidelines. So in such cases, all you have to do is follow or meet these guidelines, that at least the principal should be protected. The person who is issuing the debentures should be of a minimum net worth of 100 crores. So some certain protections they have built in, but they've acknowledged the fact that the returns on debentures can be linked to even underlying listed equity shares.
And the good part is there is no cap on the returns which they have prescribed.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Rohan, who will come after you, or who will come after these kind of equity-based debt instruments, really the tax authorities, who will probably tomorrow when the GAR, et cetera, comes in, will say that, you know, this is not really a debt and I'm going to recharacterize it. But let's see how that frames up. But my apprehension would be more from...
Right, we'll just pay the equity gain, and which is capital gain free. So we're better off if they come
and say, qualify that as dividends.
Right?
So that is how we, let's see how it evolves in times to come after GAR.
What I actually fear is that, you know, new foreign investors who come in and think this is paper and not equity, and hence, you know, issue paper and then sit back, relax, and enjoy the flight. I worry for those situations. So I think what you guys need to do is your clients, as and when the newer clients who are not familiar with India, tell them that, look, this is paper, this is an NCD, it has payment obligations, but you know what? It's an equity deal. Make sure you get all your other rights. Make sure you're doing your work. Make sure you're working with a company to make sure that you get paid, et cetera, et cetera. Add whatever value you need to. Don't sit back and think this is debt and I'm going to get paid.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So just one point. I think it's very interesting point which Rich has raised, that can the interest be recharacterized as dividend, or can the debt be recharacterized as equity? I think that is where it becomes very important on how you are documenting your entire agreement. Because what GAR says is that if your main purpose is to avail of tax benefits, then the GAR provisions will apply. So if you are able to justify that there was one more commercial purpose in addition to structuring it in the form of a debt instrument, then you are out of CAR, which is a big breather which CAR provisions with the government has given in the revised amendments. Earlier it was that if one of the main purposes is to avail of tax benefits, CAR will apply. And in most of the cases, one of the main purposes is always to avail of tax benefit. Even as a salaried person, if somebody invests in a provident fund, it is to avail of tax benefit, but that cannot result in triggering of CAR. So I think this is very important that when you are documenting the investment agreement, you clearly bring out the commercial intent behind doing a particular structure in addition to, you know, whatever commercial.
So I guess one of the intent here could be that, you know, the other guy was offering me at a fixed coupon, was offering but a much higher coupon, and my coupon by doing the structured deal turns out to be a little cheaper than that. So that's really my commercial non-tax reason for doing this. I mean, there are ways to structure it from a tax perspective.
I think we are almost out of time. So I think bottom line is that, as Rohan rightly pointed out, all of you should be very clear as to what an NCD is. It's not just paper. It's actually an equity deal, but structured as debt. And I think, again, Rohan, as you pointed out, in jurisdictions where there are so many regulations, exchange control regulations, various other regulations, there are always people are always trying to find the next structure to use which fits every criteria. So I think India has found the NCD as at least for now, and as Ruchir pointed out, all the regulators seem to have blessed it. But do be careful and come to us for your structuring of NCDs. Maybe I'll now open the floor for any questions that any of you have for any of us. Can the mic be...
Excuse me, this is the operator.
We have crossed some debt issuances from Indian company in foreign currency, whereby the debt has been issued by a foreign overseas company with a corporate guarantee from India. Now, in that case, what Deepak has mentioned, that there is no trust, obviously, in that case. It's just a corporate guarantee, and which does not involve SEBI. It probably involves only the Reserve Bank of India, because individually and corporate-wise, you cannot give an offshore guarantee. So when the liability does crystallize, what is the in dollar?
Sorry, sir. I guess you're talking in context of an Indian company giving a corporate guarantee for a debt taken offshore in foreign currency. So then there is no...
Well, in that case, there is no security trustee required, right? Because, by the way, all these listed non-convertible bonds we were talking about are rupee denominated. They're not foreign currency. So in this situation, it's really an offshore loan. You take a... You crystallize your debt from the offshore court wherever you are, bring it to India for the purpose of enforcement. I think, Vivek, you can add if there's anything else.
Yeah, I think then your question was, what do you do with the guarantee? But I guess that's one of the securities you've taken. You'll have to obviously ensure that the guarantee has been issued appropriately under the guarantee regulations of the Reserve Bank of India. So the guarantor should have been capable of having issued. So you should get a legal opinion stating that the guarantee is validly issued, because we have guarantee regulations under the Foreign Exchange Management Act. If that is okay, then the question is the enforcement of the guarantee. Then, of course, you have to go to India, because the guarantee has been given to you by an Indian party to eventually enforce it, whether you have an arbitration or you have a court action. Enforcement you'll have to do in India. So you're right. It's the Reserve Bank of India rules that you should make sure have been complied with when that guarantee was given.
Cheaper money.
So one is cheaper money. The second is under the Indian Overseas Direct Investment Regulations. An Indian company cannot invest more than 400% of its net worth for acquiring a foreign company. So the way it is structured is you set up a subsidiary outside India, and that's how all the Tata Corus and Jaguar and all these acquisitions have taken place. If you want to acquire a company which is much larger than your size, then you set up an offshore SPV, and that offshore SPV leverages from offshore banks.
So there can be many reasons.
So to that extent, you know, you even if you fall outside 400% of net worth, you can borrow abroad and use that money to acquire companies abroad.
Okay.
Yes.
CH subsidiary in a foreign country, but seeing Tata, doesn't like, don't you need to have like a foreign person also like as a director, like not Indian person cannot be the director in the foreign subsidiary directly without, so how would you structure that?
So typically the way, like for example Tata's, I mean for them it was not a problem, they structured it through their Singapore company and they have people sitting in Singapore. So that Singapore company then, you know, can leverage or can further set up a step-down subsidiary. You are right. You ideally should not have the entire board of a foreign company with Indian directors, because then there could be a potential tax risk in India of the foreign company being considered a tax resident of India. But usually, you know, the large corporates have, you know, people sitting outside India and they always take the help of the administrators. Who specialize in providing directors in their respective jurisdictions. So that has also sometimes helped in the composition of the board in a manner where the Indians are not in majority on the board of foreign companies.
I have a small question for Rajiv. Earlier you spoke about Indian companies flipping to foreign offshore companies, like the complete shareholding. But wouldn't it have like major stamp duty implications?
It has.
And FDI, it would have to go through FDI norms as well.
Yeah, so you'll have to structure all of that. So you come to us, we'll structure for you.
Mr. Menon. Over here.
I was at a seminar 2 days ago at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy, where a speaker, the seminar was on competitiveness of India, where a speaker from India said that about 68% of FDIs into India is actually Indian money outside India. I was shocked by that, really, and coming through Mauritius. Now, my question is, if the authorities change the spectacles following the new government, do you see any fallout? Thank you.
Maybe I'll take a shot at that. I don't know where this person would have got. There is this underlying.
Just to clarify, he's the head of the Center for Policy Alternatives in New Delhi, Mohan Guruswamy.
Yeah. Okay. No, there is a. I'll be guarded now in my response, since you've told me who it is. No,
and I had a chat with him, and he said...
You shouldn't have told him who it was.
No, but I think, look...
He gave me the permission to quote him.
Okay. There is this... it's not only in India. I think other countries have the same problem.
Of course,
China has the same problem. And it's obviously because of the stringent regulations that each of these countries have had in place, both from a tax perspective as well as from exchange control perspective, that some amount of round tripping, as you call it, does take place. So there's nobody can shy away from that. Having said that, I think as markets in India have been maturing over a period of time, I'm sure Rohan and others will confirm this. A lot of non-Indian money, genuine non-Indian money, comes into India. The government is trying to trace or trying to put in place certain processes. Some of the jurisdictions from where this money is coming have strengthened their KYC norms, whether it's Mauritius, Singapore, etc. So I think that's not a big problem. It's a problem that I think will eventually reduce when the regulatory framework in India becomes more investor friendly and less complex. So I think that would be a general response I would give. I don't know about 68% of the investment is Indian money. Some of it could be, but maybe if any of you have ideas. Rohan, please.
May I take a second?
Absolutely.
So, sir, I think this is a serious issue, by the way. I wouldn't downplay it at all, in my opinion, because we face the wrath of it, which means that, you know, everybody gets painted by the same brush. And we've been completely transparent with the Indian authorities whenever they've asked us for questions on beneficial ownership, etc.
coming to something that we discussed earlier, which was Singapore jurisdiction, I think that is a remedial measure, because I think the KYC norms, the regulatory environment here, the MAS, which is the Monetary Authority of Singapore, et cetera, if you're licensed by them, which we are, is the gold standard, I think, as far as regulation is concerned, and all these things are taken care of there. And that has been a major reason for us to, we've been present in Singapore since 2006, but in the last 4 or 5 years, we have significantly ramped up our business here for investing in India, and this is one major reason, because, you know, we get kind of put in the same bucket with situations where this stuff could be happening. And, you know, you want to segregate yourself and be in a far more regulated environment, especially when you have a legit business. So I think it is a serious issue, and I think it will, if the government clamps down on this, it's going to seriously impact flows. And I see that they're doing it. I mean, I see that they're doing it in terms of there is genuine effort for them to kind of figure out if there's round-tripping, et cetera, happening, which I think is a good sign. It may be some short-term pain in terms of capital flows. I mean, think if non-resident Chinese couldn't invest in China, right? It's a big deal. But I think over the long term, it's good for the country in terms of being having the appropriate type of capital coming in as foreign investment.
I think the good thing which has happened in the last couple of years with India, a lot of pension funds and sovereign wealth funds have been putting in huge amounts of funds in India, Indian companies like Canadian Pension Fund, Dutch Pension Fund. They have invested, you know, more than $1 billion or committed to invest more than $1 billion in India. Similarly, if you look at the sovereign wealth fund, GIC, ADIA, Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, Qatar Investment Authority, all this patient capital which is coming in is also good for the industry. Because typically when you have limited life capital, there is a lot of pressure to invest, there is a lot of pressure to exit, you don't look at the quality of the asset at times. With this patient capital coming in, there is much more sense which prevails both at the time of investment and the time of exit. So overall, it's good for India that the quality of capital is improving over a period of time.
Last question. Sorry about that. We can catch up over tea.
Actually, the money, what he rightly says is the government is quite aware that there is money coming back. Now, the money which is coming into the hot money, that is your equity market, obviously is being discouraged, etc. But the money that is coming under the FDI route into generating employment and jobs or whatever it is, I think nobody is really looking at it, especially in the form of mezzanine debt.
Thank you. Maybe someone who has dialed in has a question.
Sure,
we'll be happy to take that question. So, Karuna, up to you.
Sure. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Anyone from the audio bridge, if has a question, may press star and one. We have a question from the line of Sumit Danuka from Angipit Capital Partners. Please go ahead.
I would like to take the point which Rohan raised, specifically around the issue on controls for transactions in the Indian landscape. After structuring equity instruments as or structuring equity as debt, how do you ensure that the control issue is still taken care of with the fundamental instrument still being in the nature of debt?
Oh, we never just do the debt. So we will basically we'll do the debt and the equity. We will not do only debt. So typically we would, in any of our NCD investments, we'd still be 50% of the equity and 50% of the board and 50% of the control and not just be paper, which is what we like to do.
Yeah.
But I don't see a lot of people doing that. I don't know. What do you guys see?
Yeah. No, I think that's fine. Just to add, sometimes if you're not able to hold equity as a foreign investor because, let's say, it's not an FDI-compliant asset, And if it's not FDI compliant, then you may not be able to hold equity and you can only hold debt instruments like this. You can still have certain amount of affirmative rights, etc. But as Rohan correctly said, you would never be able to have full control. You would always be having an array of negative rights, but you would never get full control to drive the company.
Thanks. I think we have run out of time and we need to start our next panel. So those on the call, if you have further questions, you may email them to us. We'll circulate an email address later, and then we can share it with the panel. So Rohan, thanks so much for your time. I know you're in a rush, and everyone else, my colleagues from NDA, thank you. And for the audience, please stay. We have one more panel on real estate investment trusts, and we have Kuang Weng, who's the general counsel of Mapletree, patiently sitting in the last row. Kuang Weng, I'll ask you to make your way to the high table quickly. My apologies, Shobhit. I didn't mean to leave you out. Shobhit is with JLL, and he's come from India. A lot of experience in the real estate space. So I thought it would be good to have someone who is the general counsel who manages four REITs, which are listed on the Singapore Stock Exchange, Kuang Weng. Shobhit, who comes with a wealth of experience on the capital market side with JLL. And, of course, the experts, quote-unquote, from NDA. So maybe I will just quickly start by saying that many of you may have heard that India has recently introduced a real estate investment trust regime. This has been in the works for a few years, but the new regulations that SEBI has announced have come into force. And as a law firm, we've started getting questions now from our clients as to how does one structure a real estate investment trust. It's very new for India, and it's very new to India, but it's a very exciting opportunity for the whole real estate ecosystem. So maybe if I could quickly start by asking Ruchir a question. Ruchir, you've been doing a lot of you've been giving a lot of advice, and I know you're working on probably one of the first REITs that is going to be set up in India. So can you give us a very quick background of how these regulations have evolved and what we are seeing today?
Sure. I think just for everyone's benefit, there is a paper which is kept on that table there which sets out our analysis of the draft REIT regulations. You can pick it up from there now or later for an understanding. I think these draft REIT regulations are the third attempt by SEBI to launch a REIT regime. SEBI first came out with draft REIT regulations in 2008, which never took off. Then it came out with real estate mutual fund regulations with some prohibitive requirements, like a daily NAV, which you could probably never do in real estate, or, you know, encumbrance-free property, litigation-free kind of property kind of requirements. And that regime also never took off. Even though the regime exists, they've no one registered as a real estate for a real estate mutual fund. And I think there was a lot of pressure on SEBI and the MOF this time to come up with a very effective REIT regime. The reasons or the driver from SEBI perspective were several. I think one of the major reasons for SEBI has been the protection of the retail investors. Today, Indians, you know, by mindset, at least two, three things are very essential, right? One is investment in gold, second investment in real estate, probably third is marriage, you know. So that is a priority that real estate takes in India. So you have to have real estate. And Indians would invest, you know, and there were various kind of schemes which were coming out. You know, you put in 20% now, 80% later, you get this asset, that asset, and, you know, the retail investor was not getting enough protection while he wanted exposure to real estate. So I think from SEBI's perspective, the primary driver was retail investor protection and giving them what we call as an asset-backed investment opportunity with established revenue streams. Because if you even invest in a listed company, there is no established revenue stream. It may, the company may upstream dividends, may not upstream dividends. So in a REIT, you get to own the real estate asset, benefit from capital appreciation, yield by putting in a small amount, just as little as 2 lakhs in, you know, in this, and be assured that whatever revenues come will always be upstream. So 90% of revenues of the REIT will have to be upstreamed. Another larger picture that came up before SEBI was that more and more Indian asset-heavy companies were listing in Singapore. So it may turn out sooner that for listing Indian real estate, India may not be a good market, and Singapore may be a better market. In fact, that's a debate which still continues, that who values Indian real estate better. In fact, you know, Shobhit can probably elaborate on that, and many people still feel that probably Singaporeans would value Indian real estate better than what Indians would. And we had, and we had the apprehension that we might be exporting our capital markets to Singapore. Just like for software, no one looks at India. If it's software, you'd think of NASDAQ or NYSE, right? So there was a fear of exporting Indian capital markets offshore. I think that was another macro picture. Third, core assets, unlike residential assets in India, which are always bought and sold, right, and are self-liquidating in nature, there is core assets have lease rentals. And the question is that Indian market is probably now matured enough, and developers also need an exit. You build up a shopping mall, it's huge. Strata sale is probably not the way to exit. You need some guy who's coming in and buying it from you. Today, for the players like Blackstone, et cetera, who've invested millions of dollars into ready assets, what is their exit? Who buys it from them? Strata sale is not the way. So the market is probably matured up. And I think in closer quarters of the government, there's a thought that is going on that we must free up commercial real estate from residential real estate. Because why we put fetters on foreign investment into residential real estate is speculative land trading. But when you're coming in a commercial real estate market, you're not coming in for land trading or speculative activity. You're running a business, right? Just like you're running a hotel, you're running a warehouse, you're running a business. So there was a thought that it should be allowed, you know, these kind of asset classes where you take business risk must be monetized. And I think the other most important part was that there was a requirement, you know, Indian capital markets, if you need to encourage, you know, there needs to be depth. And they have been dormant for a while. And we believe that from REITs, you know, if they take off, there should be some amount of depth that may come in into the, you know, into the Indian capital market. And then, of course, there were a spate of reasons beyond this that, you know, REITs would lead to better kind of real estate quality because REITs would typically reinvest money, enhance yield in the project, you know, so the REIT-owned projects are typically better and all of that. So, but these four or five were largely the broader reasons why there was an inherent urgency in the MOF. And today, real estate is the largest, real estate infra, the largest absorbers for foreign investment. If we need foreign investment, we need to provide adequate investment opportunities. And foreign investors, as we've seen, and we've seen the stories of India Bulls here, which was not that successful, was because we threw in developmental assets there. It's the developmental assets which spoiled the story. And I think for many of these kind of players who are here in, you know, in Singapore, wherever, the interest in India is probably there, but there is not much interest in developmental assets. The interest is only in core assets or yield-generating assets. And where is that opportunity? REITs are intended to provide that kind of opportunity. And that's why the focus to tap that kind of foreign capital, large foreign capital base.
Thanks for that background, Ruchir. And I think just to add a point, I was looking at the FDI statistics that the Government of India published for this quarter. And if you look at the sectors that receive the maximum foreign investment, number one has always been the services sector, but number two is construction, development, and real estate. So just adding to what you said, it's the second largest recipient of foreign money. And therefore, I think the more avenues available for foreign investors to invest in efficient manner in Indian real estate, obviously it's going to be positive for everyone, for the country, for all the stakeholders involved. But it's so new and draft regulations. And so Kwong Weng, maybe you can... You know, Singapore is a much more mature REIT market. You manage, I guess, four REITs which are listed on the Singapore Stock Exchange. You also invest in India in development assets. Can you give us some background of, A, how the REIT regime has developed in Singapore and your thoughts on what maybe India should be doing?
Sure. Thank you, Vivek. Thank you for having me on the panel. I think very quickly and briefly, the first and foremost, the key point of the Singapore REIT regime is that it has a very attractive tax status or tax treatment. So if you were to look at the update that Nishit Desai Associates has put up on the draft SEBI regulations for REITs, you would be able to see that whilst it is in its third draft, there is still some uncertainty as regards the tax treatment. And when you look at the tax treatment, in Singapore especially, you would see that the Singapore regime has accorded a very favorable tax treatment on a few aspects. Firstly, on acquisition. In other words, when a Singapore REIT does an acquisition of local assets, there is a stamp duty exemption. So I think this gives a lot of impetus for buyers as well as for the way in which the transaction is being structured since stamp duty is exempted. Second, we all know that the first REIT in Singapore started more than 10 years ago, and today, thanks to the promotion by MAS as well as our SGX friends who are right beside me just now, the REIT market in Singapore has flourished to the extent that we have a very big market. In fact, if you have read the Asia Wall Street Journal today, there is an interesting article on the front page today on the REIT and as well as the business trust market. But be that as it may, it comes to my second point that the tax regime is also favorable for foreign income in the sense that there is a relief on foreign source income. And although this kind of tax relief, whether for stamp duty or for foreign source income, are subject to a sunset clause, but often than not, these reliefs and are extended when the sunset clause comes into its last days. So whilst the REIT market is watching in some anticipation for in Singapore in relation to foreign source income, which seems to have some uncertainty by the time it comes to 31st March 2015, but I think this twin focus of stamp duty exemption as well as relief from foreign source income has driven the REIT market in Singapore to a different dimension or a different paradigm. Of course, that's from the angle of a REIT player. In other words, whether you are a REIT sponsor or you are an independent REIT player. But from the perspective of a REIT investor, whether you are a corporate unit holder or an individual unit holder, you may also be aware that the tax regime for unit holders are also very favorable because there's a direct tax pass-through. In fact, for individual REIT unit holders, you have a complete exemption from income tax. So that creates a very favorable environment. For qualified institutional investors, you are only required to pay tax at a reduced rate of 10%. So again, from the perspective of a unit holder of a Singapore REIT, you are therefore given these two very attractive impetus that you should invest. But I think besides the tax angle, from both the perspective of the acquirer as well as the unit holder, I think it remains to be said that the perception of the Singapore tax regime as well as the REIT regime has taken on a different shine because if you compare it, say, with the Hong Kong REIT regime, we have grown by leaps and bounds, largely because the perception is that the Singapore REITs tend to be a congregation of very choice assets compared in some other markets. And I dare say, even in the Malaysian markets, or to some commentators have said that even in the Hong Kong markets, the not-so-good assets are often packaged into a REIT to be sold, and the choice assets are then left in the stable of the landowners. So I think on that few factors, it has driven the Singapore market to a very intensive, and a very interesting market to attract capital in terms of investors, in terms of fund managers from the REIT industry, as well as from the perspective of retail investors.
Thanks a lot, Kwong Wing. I think that's very helpful for all of us to know because we are just about to start understanding REITs and how we'll start using them in India. And maybe, Shobhit, this is a good time for your expertise. You heard Kwong Wing, and you're also familiar with the REIT environment in other countries. Do you think this is a game changer for India? Have you started seeing interest? Are people calling you up?
I definitely believe this will be a game changer at some point. You know, if you just study the REITs, I'm not even talking globally, just around Asia, they're about $300 billion in market cap. We have not even started. You know, India is the call center of the world. We have 370 million square feet of grade A office space. We have 50% of our occupiers are U.S. multinationals, probably Fortune 500 companies. How can you not allow retail participation or deepening of this market? You have to create institutional assets. So there is, in my mind, there's no doubt that this is a game changer and this has to be sort of given way too. I mean, I think we've been holding back way too long. So in my mind, this is going to change the game, and it's a win-win for the investors and the manufacturers of these assets. So I think in 2005, when they allowed FDI, I think, and you know, 2008 they attempted to do REITs. I think probably there wasn't enough quality assets. Today, people like Ascendas, MapleCreator, DLF, Blackstone—they've all helped in creating that bucket. It's probably time to now sort of allow people to come in. I know there are tax inefficiencies in the drafts that have come out, but that's not worrying me too much because, you know, if government has moved this much, my guess is that they will take the next step when they see a reciprocating gesture from the developers or holders of these assets to say, okay, fine, you moved, let's attempt to move in there. My worry today is on how the markets are going to value it. Right? Let us assume that the tax is clear. You also have stamp duty exemption. I mean, it's too much to ask in India, but I guess just to put it in perspective, let's get it there. How does it construct? Right? I guess for foreign investors to come in, Indian investors have to come in. Then the cap rates have to be more than the government securities, right, which is at 8% in India. So really, on private side, we are trading these assets at about 10 to 11%. We've been involved in some of the best transactions in India on institutional trades. Now, developers don't want to, if 10 is the market at the private side, they're not going to sort of list it at 10. It has to be much below that. And then there are leakages of managers and things like that. So really, I think the challenge in our mind or in my mind is to construct the total returns that the investors are looking for. And tax is a smaller part, but my guess is that will get resolved. And maybe going forward, we can debate this a little bit more. But I'm going to leave it to you guys to discuss the tax first and then come back again to the commercial.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Shobhit. I think that's so overall, you're positive. You have some concerns on how it's going to be valued and the construct, and assuming that tax and stamp duty works itself out in some form or the other. Maybe quickly, Deepak, very briefly, if you could just tell us some of the key parameters of these regulations. We have talked about REITs, and we don't want to go into too much detail because that information will be available to you in our newsletters, but some important aspects of these draft regulations.
Sure. So, like Richard mentioned, this is the third attempt by SEBI to introduce REITs. So this time, the good thing is a lot of thought process has gone into the drafting of the REIT regulations. SEBI has clearly elucidated the parties who will be involved in the REIT, their roles, their responsibilities, and investor protection rights have also been incorporated in the REIT regulations. So just quickly, the REIT has been proposed to be set up as a trust. It cannot be a company or a partnership or a body corporate. It has to be set up as a trust. The units of the REITs have to be listed. So that's how the REIT structure is going to work. Now, in terms of parties, so I'll be just discussing the parties to the REIT, how the REIT can raise money, where all it can invest, and few investor protection rights. Now, parties to the REIT would be your sponsor. He will be the one who will be typically throwing the assets into the REIT pool. So there are certain conditions which the sponsor has to constantly maintain. For instance, he has to ensure that at least 15% of the REIT assets or REIT units have to be held by the sponsor to ensure skin in the game. That's about sponsor. Now, next is the trustee. Trustee is the person who will be holding the assets in his name for the benefit of the unit holders again. So for trustees, there are a couple of onerous obligations, but yeah, since the draft rate regulations, the final rate regulations are yet to come out, those things, those creases might iron out. For instance, it has been in the draft rate regulations contemplate that trustees have to ensure that the real estate title is clear and proper. Now, the good thing is, unlike the previous REMF regulations, which provided that the REIT property, there should be no litigation on the REIT property. And as you may be aware that there are hardly any properties in India which do not have litigations. But here in this draft REIT regulations, they have provided that so long as you disclose it, it is fine. So trustee, and again, so trustee is going to supervise the manager, and he's going to be interface for the unit holders. Then third is the manager. Manager is going to play the most important role. He is going to make all the investment decisions as to, you know, where to invest the REIT assets and where to invest the REIT monies. He is going to manage the property, and he is going to run the entire IPO process. And he has to ensure that the valuation has to be done on a half-yearly basis. Now, again, unlike REMF, the earlier mutual fund regulations, where the regulations provided that the NAV or the valuation has to be done on a daily basis. Now, for real estate, to find out the valuation on a daily basis is going to be almost impossible. So here they have provided the mechanism that on a half-yearly basis, the valuer has to determine the value, and within 15 days thereon, the NAV should be decided. So that's about the manager. And then the valuer, again, valuer, a lot of importance has been given because REIT just holds the assets. So for valuer, there are certain stringent guidelines as to, you know, minimum number of years experience. And they're also provided a construct of two valuers. One is the principal valuer, the secondary valuer. And in certain cases, you take the average of the two. So these are the parties to the REIT. Now, in terms of raising money, the REIT, the first go, they have to raise money through an IPO process. At least 250 crores has to be offered to the public. And public shareholding or public unit holding should not fall below 25%. That is the idea. And then going forward, the REIT can also raise money through rights issue or a QIB. You know, so that's how the REIT is going to raise money. Now, in terms of unit holding also, the public holding should not fall below 20 unit holders. So at least 20 unit holders have to hold the REIT units throughout. Now, in terms of investment, the REIT regulations clearly provide that REIT can hold assets directly, or it can also hold the assets through an SPV. So if it is holding an asset through an SPV, it has to ensure that at least 50% of the shares are held by the REIT. And the remaining other shareholder, he doesn't have any rights which can obstruct or which can prevent the REIT from fulfilling his obligations under the REIT regulations. And in terms of investment, at least 80% of the REIT value has to be invested in completed and range rating asset, which means that at least 75%, so that has also been defined, at least 75% of the leasable area in that property has to be leased out. That is when it qualifies as a range rating asset. So this is where, and also now the latest board meeting, they've given the final approval for REIT regulations. They have introduced some few other criteria that REIT earlier, they could, as per the draft regulations, they could invest only in one property. Now the board meeting has provided that the REIT has to invest at least in two properties. So they have ensured that there is no single unit, single asset REIT. It has to have at least two assets. And again, each asset should not be more than 60% of the total value. So it can't be just, you know, one small flat or one small commercial property. It has to be a substantial asset. So that is the in terms of the conditions in terms of investment. Then the regulations also provide various investor protection mechanisms. For instance, for certain related party transactions, they have provided thresholds beyond which the unit holder approval has to be taken. In certain cases, 50%, certain cases, 75%. Certain cases, they have also imposed the approval on the number of unit holders. So that that provides the, you know, protection to the investors. So that, and also most important, for instance, buying and selling of property, there they have clearly provided that if you're buying and selling property, you take the value average of the two. And then if you're buying, it should not be above the average. If you're selling, it should not be below the average. So those kind of protections have been built in terms of investor protection. And last is the delisting. Since the units of the REIT have to be listed throughout, if the number of units fell below 20 or unit holders fell below 20 or there are certain other conditions, then the units of the REIT have to be delisted and the property has to be disposed and the proceeds have to be repatriated. And also just one last point. The unlike Singapore REITs, where the proceeds or the lease rentals have to be upstreamed only to get the tax benefits, under the draft regulations, at least 90% of the net lease rentals have to be upstreamed just to qualify as a REIT under the Indian regulations. So the lease rentals have to be constantly upstreamed to the unit holders on a half-yearly basis.
Kong Wing, is it very different from what you have here, some of the things that Deepak mentioned, or are there some similarities in the regulatory framework?
Sure. Thanks, Deepak, for those rendition of the key points of the draft regulations. Well, it's largely similar. Of course, there are some nuances and some minor changes, but it really remains to be seen how this will take off, especially with what Sobit has talked about on the valuation and the investor perception.
Thanks. Maybe Nischal, from structuring perspective, and I think Sobit and others also mentioned about the tax issues that appear to be in the draft regulations. So how would you go about advising the government, firstly, I suppose, on what the tax framework for a REIT should be, and then how would you structure it?
Sure. So as all of you can see the structure diagram, currently the sponsor can transfer the REIT assets in two ways. One is a direct transfer of the REIT asset, which is where the REIT is directly holding the asset. And the second structure is that there is already an SPV which is holding the asset, and the sponsor transfers the shares of the SPV to the REIT. So the REIT will hold the shares of SPV and the SPV will hold the REIT asset. Now, for any REIT regime to be successful, it's very important that we marry the sponsor taxation and the unit holder taxation. Only if both the sponsor and the unit holder taxation are efficient, then only the REIT regime could be successful. Obviously, as Shobit mentioned, that you know, tax may be a small part, but it again depends on what is the gross return, because if tax is a substantial part of gross return, which itself is a smaller number, then you know it may not be tax efficient for the unit holders. So what the government has proposed right now is, if we first take the sponsor taxation, government has said that if a sponsor transfers the shares of an SPV which is holding the REIT asset, then there will not be any capital gain at the time of transfer of the REIT asset or transfer of the shares of the SPV to the REIT at the time of transfer of the asset. So what government has said, we will not tax you at the time of transfer of the REIT asset, but what we will do is that the REIT units which you get against transfer of the REIT assets or the shares of the SPV to the REIT, when you actually transfer those units in future on the exchange, we will tax you at that point in time. So one of the concerns with the sponsor community has been having is that, let's say you are transferring a $100 asset at $200 to REIT. At that time, ideally, you would have paid $100 of capital gains to the government. What government is saying that I will not tax you at that time, but when you are $200, in case it becomes, let's say, $300, I will tax you on $300 minus $100, which was the original cost of acquisition of your shares of the SPV. So I'll tax you on the $200. Now, one of the concerns which the sponsor community, as I mentioned, is having is that for all other unit holders, when they transfer units on the floor of the exchange, they are not taxed. So what they are saying is that, why are you taxing us for the gain from 200 to 300? Because that is something which you are anyways not taxing the other unit holders. So that's a major concern which the sponsors are facing. Second concern which they have is government has not provided any tax exemption for a sponsor to directly transfer the REIT asset into the REIT. So only exemption which is there currently is if you are transferring the shares of SPV, but if you are directly transferring the asset, there is no exemption which has been provided. So that's on the sponsor taxation. Let's come to the unit holder taxation. Now for unit holder taxation, it's important to understand how the REIT would get taxed. Typically, there will be three streams of income from, in case, you know, we are following the SPV structure, where if there is no debt in the structure, the SPV will pay a 30% corporate tax on the lease rentals that it receives. When the SPV upstreams cash to the REIT, there will be a dividend distribution tax of 17% with the SPV will pay. The REIT will be exempt from tax and so would be the unit holder. So overall, if there is no debt in the structure, you will end up paying about 40 to 43% tax on the REIT structure. But one of the things which SEBI has also provided is that you can leverage up to 49% of your total REIT assets. So to that extent, if you are able to build the debt component in the structure, then there is a way in which you can pretty much achieve a tax pass-through for the entire structure. Obviously, the unit holders will still have to pay tax. So let's say if you are able to interpose debt into the structure, and once we interpose the debt, what will happen is we'll be able to wipe out the taxable income in the form of lease rentals with the interest which the SPV pays to the REIT. So SPV doesn't pay any tax. On interest, there is no dividend, there is no distribution tax. The REIT is also tax exempt. The only tax that is imposed on interest is 5% withholding tax for non-residents and 10% withholding tax for Indian residents. Now, here it is where for Indian residents, it's not the most tax efficient structure because Indian residents still have to pay additional 20% tax because their basic tax rate is 30%. But this structure becomes very important for non-resident investors because if you are coming from a jurisdiction where anyways the interest income is getting taxed and in that jurisdiction the Indian trust is considered as a pass-through, then the 5% withholding tax which is paid in India will be available as a credit in the local jurisdiction. If that happens, then pretty much for the non-resident holder, the entire structure is a tax pass-through because there is no foreign tax that they are paying. The only tax that they are paying is the tax in their own jurisdiction. So with this debt structure, if it is possible to achieve a tax pass-through for the entire structure, obviously there are still more demands from the sponsor and the developer and the fund management community that there should not be any dividend distribution tax in case we are using an equity structure, because they are comparing it with a listed company model. Let's say a developer is having a listed company which is owning commercial assets. For those listed companies, it is not mandatory to distribute dividend. It is at the board's discretion on whether it wants to distribute dividend or not. As compared to that, in case of a REIT, SEBI has mandated that at least 90% of the net distributable cash flows of the REIT have to be mandatorily distributed to the unit holders. And because it's mandatory, they have to also pay dividend distribution tax. So there are proposals which have been made to the government to further relax some of these tax proposals. But the way I look at it is even if these tax proposals are kept in the same form, there are still structures which could be worked out to make the entire structure pass through.
I think that's very interesting because as we heard in the first panel, debt, we discussed a lot about debt. Debt seems to be finding its way into a REIT structure as well as far as achieving some sort of a tax pass-through, at least at the REIT level. And the other good thing, I think, is that this government at least has given the signs that it's willing to listen to people and take everyone's views when finalizing regulations. So whilst we may not get all the tax benefits that one is seeking, it's a more engaged government. It's a more online government. So all of us and all our peers have been contributing a lot of advice to the government and recommendations. And finally, of course, I think one will wait and see what form these final regulations take. Maybe quickly, I think we have 15 minutes before the session ends, but Kwong Wing, I would like to ask you and then wrap up with Shobhit. I think audience has heard the lawyers more now. I know you're also a lawyer, but you're in-house, so it's different. What would drive investors to invest in Indian REITs? If I was to ask you, if you were an investor, what would drive you to do it?
Well, if you ask any investor, I think the first and foremost question that comes to mind is, what is my return? So at the end of the day, the return versus, say, the risk-free rate, would it be an attractive hurdle for me to cross, and how certain is that hurdle? So in the same way, if you look at it from the Singapore REIT regime, where just like the draft regulations that SEBI has passed out, where every REIT is legally mandated to pay out 90% of its net distributable income. I think that will go a long way to assure the investors that you have a steady stream compared to other investment products or structures, or even for that matter, compared to a business trust in Singapore. So I think the return or the perception of the security of the return will be something that is very fundamental. Of course, then it goes back to Shobit's point about what is the, you know, the certainty or the differential towards the return versus the risk-free rate, as I mentioned. So I think that is a question of valuation, but at the same time, we all know, as you can hear earlier, that valuation oftentimes is driven by the underlying taxation structure and also the underlying tax structure. In Singapore, a REIT can leverage up to 60, you know, especially if it's rated. So in the same way, if the correct structure, including the debt structure and the capital structure, is put in place, then it will go a long way to drive the certainty of the return. Finally, I think it goes back to a very fundamental point that what are the safeguards if the REIT product turns sour? In other words, what are the investor protection features that the REIT has contained? So I think for the Singapore regime, the goal or the platinum standard that we heard about from MAS and from SGX has gone a long way to assure investors that you know, there's no concentration risk or single asset risk, the kind of risk that we talked about earlier, compared to the Indian regulations. That although in the detailed comparisons, you don't have a provision in the Singapore REIT regimes that require about what we talk about, that, you know, the asset has been 75% leased out and all that. But there are other requirements, such as the development limit is only restricted to 10% of the REIT NAV. So as a result, this gives a different kind of glow and a different kind of protection whenever a potential investor looks at the investment product.
Shobit, finally to you before we go to the audience for questions. Your final thoughts, what would you look for? You mentioned valuation and some of those issues, but why don't you give us some of your final thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, interesting that you know, we talk about investor protection and unit holder protection. I think you know, this time around, the Securities and Exchange Board has been very mindful, and I think they've done more than what they would have usually done in the first draft itself. So I think you know, they've taken the best features. In my mind, there may be some improvements that could be done, but that's separate. I'm not worried about investor protection. I think what we are seeing when we're doing deals on the private side is that the investors are looking at total returns of sort of mid-teens. Currently, the way it's constituted is about 10-11% is coming from income, and about 4-5% is what they're looking at from appreciation or capital gains. My guess is going forward on the REITs, if they were to, you know, they have to, my guess is they have to compete with this and they have to deliver this kind of return, we'll have to sort of re-educate the investors to say you perhaps get sub 8% as income. You have to be very, very mindful of the fact that we are in an inflationary environment. The way we write our leases have built-in rent escalations. You will make about 3-4% from appreciation on rent, and then you have a capital gains sort of piece, which is the total. When you exit, you make some profit. So my guess is that any investor will look at total returns of mid-teens, and instead of two, he probably has three legs to cover. But I think the product will offer, you know, I think it's a good product, and I'm hoping we'll see it. Investors are hoping they'll see it. So let's see how it works.
Thanks. I think we end on a positive note, and hopefully everyone gets what they seek in the new REIT regime. Let's open the floor for questions, and then we'll move to the people who have dialed in, and then, of course, we'll go out and have some tea. So any questions? Mr. Menon?
In the the proposed regulations, who will appoint the principal value and the secondary value, and to whom will they be accountable to?
The valuer appointment can be done. The valuer appointment can be done by the issuer. Accountability will, they will be accountable ultimately to the SEBI, because that's the overarching body. But the way the valuation norms are today, it has to be, the valuer has to value as per the international accepted methodologies or the ICAI or the chartered accountant prescribed methodology. And the chartered accountant methodology, you know, kind of prevails over anything else. So the way I look at it, I think you would see more of chartered accountants doing this kind of valuations, and therefore they would be accountable to CA Institute number one, and of course at the overarching level to the SEBI from an investor grievance perspective, something goes wrong.
Yeah, also just to add, what has been mentioned in the draft REIT regulation is that the valuers will have to qualify the criteria under the New Companies Act of 2013. Now, under the New Companies Act, there is this concept of registered valuer, and there are stringent penalties on the registered valuers if they don't comply with the duties under the Companies Act. So if there is any problem which you know, which happens on account of the registered valuer, not only SEBI, not only ICAI, but the Ministry of Corporate Affairs is the body which is going to also regulate these valuers. And on top of that, under the New Companies Act, there is this concept of class action suits, which has been introduced in India, which has never been there in the in India in the past. And as we know, in developed jurisdiction, this is quite a common thing. So under the class action suit also, you can sue the valuer in a situation where they have done things in a wrongful way or, you know, with a malafide intent. So it's not easy for the valuer to, you know, value the property in the way they want, because there are a lot of daggers on their head which are there.
Kong, can I just ask you, does that appear to be more stringent than we, what we have in Singapore?
Well, I think in the those of you who are involved in the REIT industry in Singapore knows that the only time that you require two valuations is when you do a RPT, which is a related party transaction. And it depends on how chummy, if I may dare say, the trustee is. Sometimes the trustee leave you to get the job done, so long as there's a sign off by the two valuers, beg your pardon. Yes, in that broad strokes, yes, it sounds like there's a lot more accountability. But although I've shared with you the chummy part of the stories, but let me assure you that the trustees are not, you know, sleeping on their job. They are still very vigilant. And they ask questions, they ask about cap rates, they ask about comparables, they ask about, you know, the DCF for RPTs. So whilst we may not require the kind of registered valuer concept in Singapore as yet, but I think the process is equally rigorous. And I think this augurs well that India is starting on perhaps a more stringent or strict footing.
Actually, I was thinking of at the start of the acquisition of an asset by the REIT.
I'm sorry, what Shobhit had mentioned about perception. Sorry to share this thought with you. Is perception is negative. And I'll tell you why. You know, he mentioned that we can sue the valuer. But by the time you get a judgment, it will be about 15 years. So that perception is what is deterring people to invest in this particular kind of a product. Security is totally different. I mean, it's a time-tested. Our stock exchange is there for about 150, 80 years, or I don't know. So there is a system in place, and there is a investor protection which is time-tested, whereas in REIT, perception is
maybe
indeed
I'll just
negative. 1 minute. I just want one more thing I want to ask you is, you mentioned that the rental return on REIT is about 10%, and you allow to leverage around 50%, as I understand, on the REIT. Are you saying that the gross rental yield, as investment guys say, is around 7% on commercial and residential property?
In
because you said 10% on rental and 5% on capital appreciation. So to get a 10% rental yield means your gross return has to be at least 6-7% on residential and commercial property.
I'm not sure what you're saying.
what we're saying is that currently the cap rate is 10%. When you distribute that, you know, there may be some losses, and that is why I think what Reed talks about is distributable surplus, and therefore there's a leakage of about 2-3% in that.
It is this, you know, to allay these kind of fears, you know, that who will the value will be accountable to, this is a very impractical valuation standard that the SEBI has prescribed. A chartered accountant to that extent may not be able to value the property as well as a property consultant like JL or someone, because it's very localized, you know. But the challenge that we were involved with SEBI in these kind of discussions while these regulations were drafted, SEBI said that, you know, I want someone whose neck I can catch. Now, I want somebody which is regulated. And, you know, merchant bankers can't value this, so, you know, okay, so what do I do? Then I will catch Chartered Accountant Institute. Now, Chartered Accountant Institute does not even have prescribed methodologies for these kind of real estate, and how will this happen? So, you know, it is this fear or this apprehension that is actually driving things to a little bit of, you know, impractical way. So that was just my thought.
Yeah, and just I think, as everything, it takes time. You yourself mentioned about the stock markets. No one fears investing in the Indian stock market. I think give it time, and once it matures, we'll probably see this market develop as well. Any more questions from the audience? Yes.
Perhaps just to add to that, if you were to rewind back the Singapore REIT history, you may or may not realize that the first REIT actually failed in its IPO. Yeah, so, I mean, everything takes time. I agree with you that it depends on where you start your baseline on the perception. But be that as it may, I think there are different strokes for different folks. If you are looking for a yield play, you may think that you know, a REIT is good. If you are looking for capital appreciation, the yield may be a bit too slow. If you are looking for a leverage product, you know, the yield may be a hybrid. I'm not sure. But at the end of the day, all I'm trying to say is that, you know, the Singapore REIT industry has also taken time in order to reach where it is today.
Yeah, my question is to Deepak. You mentioned the different entities into the REIT structure. So particularly the investors, the sponsor, the manager, is there any element of an offshore sort of entity or something which can take a play, or it's all simply onshore in terms of the entities defined?
Yeah, so the draft REIT regulations in terms of sponsor and manager, it can be anyone. The draft REIT regulations provide that investors can be both residents as well as non-residents. The only thing is, because REIT will be investing in completed assets, which are, you know, core assets, so to that extent, the RBI, which is the exchange control regulator, they will have to provide, or they have to just tweak the, you know, the exchange control regulations to provide for non-residents to invest in core assets. But that also, I think, in principle approval, they have already given. The regulations are yet to be amended for that.
Should we go to the questions? If anyone has a question on who is dialed in, Karuna, if you're still there.
Sure, sir. Participants on the audio bridge, if you wish to ask a question, please press star and one at this time. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one. Sir, there are no questions here at the moment, so you may continue, sir. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Karuna. So I think that brings us to the end of our panel discussion, but I think the most important part still awaits us. So please join us for tea outside in the foyer, where we can all catch up and ask. You can ask us more questions, or just enjoy yourselves. Thanks, Kwong Weng. Thanks, Shobhit, for all your insights. They're very valuable, and hope to see the REIT regime develop the way in which we all wanted to. And thank you all for coming, but please stay with us. 40. We'll see you all outside. Thank you.
Just before you leave, on the table, there is a Bloomberg report on which we had prepared for REITs. So the entire REIT regime in India, how SEBI has proposed, everything is covered in that report. So in case you want to carry it. Thank you.
Participants on the audio bridge, the conference has concluded. You may now disconnect your lines. Thank you.